But I'd say, you know, maybe most important is relatedness, which is we have a community of people in self-determination theory, really a worldwide community of people focused on the same question, which is how can we help students and employees and our children flourish in their lives? And that's brought me into great connections with people all over the world. And like you, it's been a long journey, an international journey, where, you know, I'm continually inspired by new opportunities to learn and to connect. So autonomy, competence, relatedness, huge in my life, but I think they're huge in everyone's life.
You're listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassily.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to my Run Your Life podcast series. And as always, I really do want to thank you for your time and energy and for tuning in to any episode that you can. The whole purpose behind my podcast series is to interview people from the world of education and beyond who strive for both personal and professional excellence in their life through their chosen profession, whatever that profession may be. Although the primary focus of my podcast is the field of education, I've had lots of different types of people on my show over the past 5 years. I started the podcast up in 2015, and over the years I've had professional athletes, Olympians, best-selling authors, CEOs, lots of different types of people. But what I enjoy doing the most is to really unpack the guiding principles that my guests take action on in their lives in order to bring about their best performance in terms of the work that they do and the strengths and talents that they bring to the world. In today's show, I feel very lucky to have Dr. Richard Ryan on the show. Dr. Ryan is a clinical psychologist and co-developer with Edward Deci of the self-determination theory, which is one of the most influential theories of human motivation. Self-determination theory is a macro theory of motivation, psychological development, and wellness. The theory itself has been widely applied on research and interventions in schools, work organizations, clinical settings, virtual environments, and sports. Dr. Ryan is one of the leading theorists of human motivation in the world and has won 3 Lifetime Achievement Awards for his contributions to the field on motivation, personal meaning, self, and identity, including the 2012 Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Network on Personal Meaning. What I really appreciated about my conversation with Dr. Ryan was his very natural, down-to-earth, friendly way that he conducted himself in this conversation. It's clear to see that he's a really kind and caring person. And despite having more than 4 decades of deep experience within the arena of human motivation, Dr. Ryan is not the type of person who demands respect, but instead he actively engages himself in dialogue with an open and curious mind about human flourishing. In particular, how educators can plant the seeds for all students to thrive and to fulfill their potential based on the uniqueness and strengths that they bring to the world. I've followed Richard's work for many years and have experimented, explored, and tested out many of the strategies and approaches related to self-determination theory and its application in teaching and learning. Regardless of the work that you do, I really think you'll find great value in Dr. Ryan's insight and ideas. You can find his work at selfdeterminationtheory.org and access a mountain of information and resources that will provide you with the tools and resources necessary to spark new possibilities in the work that you do, whatever that is. So with that, let's jump right into my discussion with Dr. Richard Ryan.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show. And before really diving into this conversation, we talked before I hit record, and I told you a little bit about my journey working in different countries around the world over the past 20 years. And
You've got such an extensive body of work that has really had an influence on my work that I do in education and the work that I bring to the teacher training workshops that I lead. So in advance to our conversation, I really want to thank you for your work and the influence you've had on our field.
Well, thanks very much for saying that. I guess, you know, as somebody who spends a lot of time writing and working and trying to develop ideas, it's always good to see anybody using them. So
I really appreciate you taking the time. You know, a lot of the listeners know about your work, but just to set the frame, can you talk just a little bit about early days, where you're from, and in particular, what sparked your interest in psychology?
Well, my interest in psychology, you know, way back. I was a philosophy major as an undergraduate, and then, of course, that means I was unemployed when I left my undergraduate years. I happened to land a job in a developmental disabilities area, helping train people to get out of institutions and to live independently. And I saw there so much the importance of motivation and also how people in learning settings are often really mistreated, particularly people with learning challenges. So I decided to go into psychology. I became a clinical psychologist. And I guess I'll just want to say this because I think it's relevant to your audience. You know, as a clinical psychologist, my intention was to just go into private practice. But we did some studies early on while I was still a graduate student in schools, and we were looking at how teachers' attitudes and treatment of kids in classrooms affected the kids' mental health and self-esteem. And we saw powerful effects of teachers on children. And I saw right at that moment that no matter how many private practice patients I could see in my life, I couldn't possibly make the kind of changes I could if I could help people provide better motivational and supportive atmospheres in schools and in workplaces and in other places. So I kind of moved my career focus from just being a clinician to also being a researcher and an interventionist.
And can you give us a time frame? Like when did you enter the field and when did you?
Well, you know, this is a really mean question because it's going to reveal how old I am. Yeah. My first studies in education were really done in the late 1970s when I got together with Ed Deci, and we started collaborating. So in the late 70s, we began the work on self-determination theory and really just been doing it since. So for the past 40 years.
And when you think of yourself, younger days, like what were the strengths that you developed early on that continued to serve you the rest of your career and still serve you to this day? So early strengths that you had developed.
You know, it's a lot easier for me to focus on my early weaknesses. I guess one thing would be that, you know, I'm a curious person. And I really do want to get to the bottom of things. And so I think even from the beginning, I was skeptical about many of the ways I was being taught or trained to motivate people or to bring people on board with initiatives. That skepticism, I think, you know, led us to develop some new ideas and new ways of thinking about motivation and wellness. So I guess one could call that a strength.
Right.
And it continues. I mean, I think healthy skepticism is good.
Yeah. And for the listeners that, again, like a lot of the listeners will know your work, but for those who are listening who aren't so familiar with it, can you kind of give a summary of self-determination theory and the main features of it? Like what do you want people to know just as a summary for those that might not know a lot about it?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people wouldn't know from the name self-determination theory what it is about. So I think it's a great question, Andy. I guess what I would say is our focus in self-determination theory is what are the conditions under which people flourish? What are the conditions in which they're active and engaged and doing the things that we humans do best, which is to learn about and take on challenges and interface with our environment? That's what people naturally are built to do. And so we're interested in what are the ingredients in any setting, whether it's an educational setting or a work setting or a sports setting, what is it that we can do that brings out the best in people, that inherent energy that they have? And we started our work with the phenomena of intrinsic motivation, which is the natural propensity people have to learn and to engage the world around them. and our interest is in. What are the things that teachers or bosses or parents do that encourages that intrinsic motivation, helps it be really robust? And what are the things that they do that sometimes unwittingly undermine that intrinsic motivation and lead kids to be more passive and less interested in what's going on around them? So that's where we began the work, was on that question of intrinsic motivation. And then really the whole question about flourishing has been the core of what we've been doing since.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And when you think about your own work and early days developing the theoretical framework, did it apply to you in your own work, you being intrinsically motivated to do the work that you do, and the three needs, autonomy, relatedness, and competence? How did that apply to you early on and throughout your career?
You know, I guess, you know, first of all, I just want to say, again, for people who might not be familiar, one of the basic tenets of self-determination theory is that people will flourish, they will be active, they will be engaged in an atmosphere where they're experiencing support for their relatedness, they can feel connected to people, where they can feel support for their competence, where they can feel effective at what they're doing, and where they can feel support for autonomy, which is being able to do the things that they personally value or find interest in. And of course, those things really apply to a researcher. I mean, one of the beauties, I guess, of a researcher's life is that it's filled with opportunities for autonomy and for competence, which is that, you know, we as a researcher, you pursue the things that interest you, hopefully, and you hope that your institutions support you in that endeavor. You get lots of competence feedback, sometimes not always pleasant, from reviewers and others, but, you know, feeling effectiveness, particularly if, you know, having people like you say, oh, I use that work. To me, that's competence feedback and part of what keeps us on. But I'd say, you know, maybe most important is relatedness, which is we have a community of people in self-determination theory, really a worldwide community of people focused on the same question, which is how can we help students and employees and our children flourish in their lives. And that's brought me into great connections with people all over the world. And like you, it's been a long journey, an international journey, where, you know, I'm continually inspired by new opportunities to learn and to connect. So autonomy, competence, relatedness, huge in my life, but I think they're huge in everyone's life, which is the core idea of the theory.
Yeah. And you've been very lucky to travel the world and work in different places and even for short stints. So you were based in Australia for a while. I think you had done some work in England as well. But so when you talk about relatedness,
Germany,
those universal connections, and which really opens your mind. And I told you about my experiences living in five different countries. My boys were born in Hiroshima, Japan. They're third culture kids. They've never lived in Canada. Canada is close to their heart. But more importantly, Japan and China and all these wonderful places around the world are also close to their hearts. So, you know, when I think of you and the work that you've done and the global impact that it's had, you probably built a very strong social support network worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really informs the work, because what you see is what is universal and what's unique in different educational and cultural settings, you know, like the situation in Singapore being very different than the situation in Finland, even though, say, both have good reputations as countries for education. Looking at the commonalities and the universalities versus the things that make them unique, I think this is part of what is really enriching about international travel and research.
Yeah. And if I was to ask you, like, if you were to think of self-determination theory early on in your career, and then how it changed. So kind of thinking about it in through the lens of, I used to think self-determination theory was, I now think self-determination theory is, based on you being a lifelong learner. How has your definition and your understanding of self-determination theory changed, and how does it continue to change to this day?
Well, anyway, I wrote a chapter recently that really is about this question, and it was called Brick by Brick, and it's is the name of the chapter. It's really about the building of a broad theory like self-determination theory from very small base. Our questions were narrow when we began. This is Ed Deasy and I. We really focused on the phenomena of intrinsic motivation. How can you bring about and spark intrinsic motivation in classrooms and in workplaces, and then what undermines it? But we quickly, I think, realized that intrinsic motivation, while it it kind of captures something really important about learners and learning atmospheres. It's not the only important kind of motivation to be fostering in a flourishing classroom. So we got interested also in internalization. So how you could help learners or employees or others internalize the value of doing something that's not intrinsically motivated. So in many of the things we have to do in schools or in workplaces are not fun. They're not interesting in the direct sense of, I can't wait to do this thing, but they're important and they have value. And so when you can help people find that value and that importance, which we call identification in our work, that facilitates their autonomously being engaged in what they're doing. And so we moved our work pretty quickly just from the phenomenon of intrinsic motivation to this question of internalization. How can we help people internalize the tasks and the values and the regimens and the habits that will do well for them that may not be interesting at the outset? So we developed a theory of internalization. As we were looking at what factors really foster intrinsic motivation and which things really enrich internalization, those things turned out to be support for autonomy, support for competence, and support for relatedness. And as we started to look at those environmental supports, we also saw, and of course, and no one could miss that when those things are being satisfied in people, their well-being goes way up. And in fact, we've been able to then show theoretically and empirically that these three needs are the essential ingredients in people's well-being. They're the necessary and they're the sufficient ingredients for people to be happy, well, and flourishing. So that led us to develop a wider theory of well-being. And then we went from there into a theory of the values and the goals that people have, because some goals just never satisfy those needs, even when you achieve them. So like getting rich, where, you know, even if you succeed at getting rich, that doesn't necessarily enhance your autonomy. In fact, it may enslave you. It does not necessarily enhance your relatedness. In fact, it may divide you from other people. It may help you feel some kind of competence in life, but maybe not even at the things you think were essential. So you can have certain goals that never fulfill needs. So even when successful, don't produce well-being. So we developed a theory of what kind of life goals really do lead to wellness. And then most recently, we've been delving into interpersonal relationships in the deep way. What makes for a really good interpersonal relationship in relation to these need satisfactions? So I always say this by way of the arc of the theory has been to go from very narrow intrinsic motivation to broader and broader issues in human development and wellness, really based around the fundamental notion that we all universally have basic psychological needs for autonomy, competence, and relatedness.
What's great I love about your work is that I listened to a talk that you gave. I saw it online. I think it was at Columbia University. And you talked about some different studies that show this is not just a Western thing. You know, this is not just a North American thing. And you and your team had done research around the world, including Russia, including some other countries where you think Russia, being a totalitarian society way back when, this same thing applies in Asia, where people think that the nail that sticks up is hammered down, so you can't place value on autonomy. But you have showed through your work that that is actually inaccurate. So can you talk about some of the cross-cultural studies that you've done that absolutely zero in on and prove that those three needs are universal?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing is that our claim is that although there are many, many differences across cultures in the way in which people develop and the values that they have, there are these three fundamental psychological needs for autonomy, for experiencing autonomy, for experiencing relatedness, and for experiencing competence, that if you have those, you have wellness, and if you don't, you don't. And we think that's universal, and so an important part of our theory is testing that across really diverse nations. And at this point, I think there's no part of the world that's been untouched by self-determination theory. I mean, I had the beautiful opportunity to work in Asia quite a bit. I spent time in Singapore, and we have colleagues in Japan and in Korea and in China and in India and really all over Asia and certainly South America. I think probably the one place we need more testing is in Africa. We've had a few opportunities in African schools in South Africa and Ghana and Nigeria, but not everywhere in Africa, but pretty much across the world. Our question has been, do these needs make a difference? And we see, and autonomy has been the controversial one. As you say, a lot of people say, well, autonomy doesn't matter in the Asian countries or doesn't matter in more traditional cultures. That turns out empirically not to be the case. The impact of having or not having autonomy is the same effect size in Asia as it is in North America. Same effect size we see in Africa as it is in South America. There's no real differences in the impact of autonomy. How autonomy gets fulfilled is different in different places. And the way it might be expressed or understood is sometimes subtly different. But the main effects of feeling like you're not being controlled, that things are not being imposed upon you, but rather you're able to act with a sense of agency and value for what you're doing, this matters everywhere in the world, regardless of culture.
I think of the word agency, and I once heard a consultant, a really well-known consultant, who does a lot of work with inquiry and agency. And what she said is there's this notion that teachers give students agency. And she said, it's so not true. They're already agentic. You can't give it to them. It's inherently within them. So yeah. It's such an important thing to understand. We don't give agency. We don't give ownership. They already have it. We take away that by the things that we do and the barriers and the obstacles that we create. When you think about self-determination theory, what are two or three misconceptions that people might have about the theory, and what can you say to clear up those misconceptions?
Sure. I guess the first thing I want to reiterate something you just said, because I think it was a core of what was revolutionary about self-determination theory when it began and what continues to be, I think, its spirit, which is, you know, when I started in this field, the whole idea about motivation was you motivated other people. You had the rewards, you had the punishments, and you activated them. Some notion that people are basically passive. And I think our view and DC's in my view, even from the beginning, was that's the wrong way to think about it. Motivation is already in human organisms. We're already motivated to do things. The question is, how do we harness that inherent motivation that everyone has? So we don't give people motivation. We find a way not to undermine it. And we find a way to direct it and channel it into things that are of value to people. Misconceptions, I think probably the main misconception that we battle over time concerns our technical use of the term autonomy. So when we talk about autonomy, what we really mean is that people are doing things willingly. So if you're acting with autonomy, you're willing to do what you're doing. That either is because you're highly interested in it, or you find interest in it, or because you understand the value and worth and merit in what you're doing. So those are the things that characterize autonomy. I think people confuse autonomy with independence. Okay, so that you're doing it on your own, but you can be autonomously independent. You can say, I want to try this on my own, in which case you're willingly doing it on your own. But you can also be autonomously dependent, which you can say, I'd really like you to help me with this. In other words, you can turn yourself over willingly to somebody else, and you'll do that for people who I think are supportive of you. Autonomy is also not about freedom. And I think this is a really important one in classrooms. So, you know, when I use the term freedom, it's like take away the constraints. But if you simply take away the constraints, what we say is you get chaos. That's the result of taking away constraints. Autonomy is about helping students find a willingness to do the work that's in front of them, not letting them do whatever they want. And so I think that some confusion around the concept of autonomy, once people read the work, they understand that, but out of the gate, I think people say, I can't have autonomy in my classroom. The kids will go wild. And they're right if what they mean is just freedom and permissiveness. That's not a helpful developmental input.
And to take your work, I want to show you or explain to you how I've tried to apply. So my background is physical education and health. I really looked into all of your studies into exercise and physical activity. And years ago, I started to test it out and to apply it in my own way in physical education. And that led to me doing a lot of consulting work with schools around the world to kind of reshape and flip the paradigm and move away from a traditional way of delivering physical education to really trying to plant the seeds for all kids to flourish. And when I heard you just kind of describe the misconceptions, I think of that idea of being dependent, asking for help is still being autonomous if you're willing to do it, you know, willing to ask for help. So a lot of the work that I've done in physical education is about helping every student find an entry point into their own learning journey and their own journey in physical activity and physical literacy. And wherever they enter the scene, you know, we present it as, what is that just right challenge for you? And then we can help facilitate their growth and learning from there. So as John Hattie says in his work, a 1 year of growth for 1 year of schooling kind of thing. But that very much depends on finding the entry point to learning, to personalized learning. And that's what I wanted to ask you about, is what is your advice to teachers who are feeling constricted by outcomes and constricted by a million other things, yet they want to provide the conditions for kids to flourish and to find their own entry point to learning? So what are some examples or stories or advice that you can give to teachers?
Well, first of all, I want to begin with great sympathy for a lot of teachers around the world who are beset by government pressures and school system pressures towards the very narrowly defined outcomes for their kids, which is basically what we call high-stakes testing. High-stakes testing has been one of the most corrupting influences on education across the world. It's not just a U.S. phenomena or Australian phenomena. It's also true in China. It's also true in some European countries. High-stakes testing spoils classroom practice because it doesn't allow teachers to find each child's optimal place of entry. It's saying everybody's going to be enter at the same place and they're going to leave at the same place. And it's just a wrong way of thinking about education. And I think teachers are hampered by this high-stakes testing movement that's been going on now for 25 years with no evidence of positive results. So it continues to be government policy without any evidence base supporting it. So that's not what the question you asked. You said, what about teachers' practices themselves? And I think probably like you, as someone who's seen a lot of teaching all around the world, I marvel at the fact that even under some bad policy conditions, there are many teachers who are really inspiring and engaging and find ways to reach their kids and reach all the kids in their classrooms. I mean, so there are great ways to do that. And in SDT, we think the best way to do that is to support the autonomy of your students. And that does require some skills, but it mostly first requires a sentiment and a belief. It requires a concern and an attitude towards students, which is when I'm presenting them with things, I want to know what their point of view is on. When I'm asking them to do something, I want to understand. I don't necessarily have them verbalize it, but I want to have a sense of how are they experiencing that, so I can address the obstacles and the barriers that are in the way of each child engaging what we're doing. So, you know, for me, the fundamental thing about great teachers are they understand the perspectives of the people who are their learners, and they're engaging in those perspectives as they transmit knowledge or help people engage in the activity of inquiry and growth. So we always see autonomy support as kind of the fundamental skill of all teaching. Then also there's skills of scaffolding competence and creating a structure in classrooms. Because again, from an SDT standpoint, the highest quality classrooms are not just autonomy supported, but they're also highly structured. And when you have those two things together, where students know what it is that they need to do, the challenges are built in such a way as that they can be successful at them if they enter into effort, and then their autonomy is supported, now we have the highly engaged classroom. That's a real art, and that's why teachers are professionals, because this is an art that takes both time and skill to develop and to learn.
Yeah, and that idea, I think, of co-constructing these success criteria and co-constructing these learning journeys with students, as you say, to really understand their perspectives. And that's the strategy or pedagogical approach that I took with a group of teachers in a grade five cycling unit. So we're in Saudi Arabia. So there are many Saudi Arabian girls who don't ride bicycles, right? Yet they just got bicycles maybe in the couple months before the unit began. They started their bicycling journey. So we had a wide variety of skills. And by getting kids to the way we did it was to allow them to just explore movement on a bicycle at the start of the unit, showing some basic safety, but then to get them to identify what was most challenging. And then we had a list of about 12 to 15 things that were most challenging that we put in a visual format on a big whiteboard. And then they could then decide which challenge they wanted to tackle. And then they would come back, and using yellow, red, green sticky dots, they would write their name on the sticky dot. Red means impossible. Yellow means kind of do it. Green means totally no problem. And then they would layer the dots. So if it started at red, they would then self-assess later and layer the yellow over, then layer the green over. So, and it was all based on their self-assessments and peer assessments. So we found, in terms of physical activity, that was a nice way to get kids, we felt, intrinsically motivated and safe, psychologically safe, to pursue learning in their own way, you know? So we felt that we really saw a lot of progress.
I just want to reflect on a few of the elements that are in your intervention that are clearly really important ones that we stress in SDT. And I just, one of them is, first, you choose an engaging activity that also has potential relevance in people's lives and interest. Mm-hmm. You gave them, you tried to understand their perspective and where each of them was coming from on that. You gave them choice over which challenges they would tackle and which speed. You weren't being evaluative in the sense of, oh, those people who have the right out of the gate, the skills, they get the A's and the others get punished in some way for them. So you were not being evaluative except for, you know, in the strong sense of outcome focused evaluation. Mm-hmm. There was just so many things in your intervention that sound congruent with the principles of autonomy, competence, and relatedness support.
Yeah, it was really rewarding. And the beautiful story that I have is, there's one Saudi Arabian girl who, when she started the cycling unit, she had an old rusty bike, really shaky on the bike. And it was a 9-week unit. We had extended the unit because we wanted the kids to get more practice, because cycling is such a lifelong skill. So we started on the basketball court using the lines in the basketball court to make sure that they could do road signals properly. That was the only non-negotiable, road signals, because we had to bring them out into the community. About halfway through the unit, we went to this kind of desert area that had some hills and slopes and like flat soil-based areas and rocky areas. And then we just set them free. Just explore and come back with your questions. So some kids had to learn how to switch gears to go over soft terrain. But this girl who was really shaky on a bike started to go down some hills. And then she had this massive smile on her face, getting more and more excited, and realized her bike was holding her back because it was old and rusty. So halfway through the unit, she convinced her dad to buy her a new mountain bike. So then she was riding, you know, going up and down hills, and she joined the after-school cycling club and started cycling to school every day. Yeah. So what a massive win. Like one of the most rewarding things I've seen in my career, about taking somebody who is not very physically active and having them fall in love with physical activity under their own terms and conditions. So we do the same thing with skateboarding, with a lot of individual pursuits type of activities. So I really want to commend you and your work, because it was you and your work that provided me with the permission to experiment with the best of intentions at heart, knowing that I was trying to do the best I could for students. So it was really, really excellent experience. But you had done a study, 23 country study, and I loved the way you described this, but it was about letter writing. And what it was, I think you had, if I'm not mistaken, you had students in 23 different countries write letters about the most demotivating teacher they ever had, the most
inspiring. Yeah, we had actually students across those countries wrote, so they were basically 5-minute essays, and they wrote one about the most demotivating teacher they ever had, describing that teacher and what the classroom was like for them. Then they wrote one about the most motivating teacher they ever had. And then those were kind of done in opposite orders for, you know, so there wasn't an order effect. And then everybody wrote an essay about a current teacher that they had. And then we analyzed those essays. And I think the thing that was quite striking is the similarity across the world of both the descriptions of the most motivating teachers that people ever had, and the ones who were most demotivating. And it really came back to the demotivating teachers were characterized by being really controlling or judgmental and often uncaring or cold. So it was really autonomy and relatedness issues. The motivating teachers were always seen as those who really cared about the students, relatedness high, the sense of being respected, that that teacher cared about them, was on their side in some ways. But also teachers were also autonomy supportive. They cared about the interest. They tried to find out about the student's interest. They took the student's perspectives or at least understood the student's perspectives in classes. Those things came out in essays across the world. We found no countries in which there were not main effects for autonomy and relatedness. And kind of surprisingly, none of these essays across the world mention the things that you hear policymakers talking about all the time. Nobody said, oh, my great teachers are the ones who graded us with rigor. Nobody said, oh, my great teachers are the ones who held us to standards. You know, nobody said that. That's just not a concept from a student's point of view of what makes for a motivating environment. What makes them a motivating environment for them is somebody who's engaged their interest, has understood their perspective, has given them a sense of agency and responsibility, and has cared about them. These are the things that really matter in classrooms. And again, with high structure, with having things that are fair and equitable, and you know what you're doing, and you feel like you're accomplishing something.
One of the things, you know, now that we're in distance learning, a lot of schools around the world, and we've had a discussion amongst teachers and leaders at our school about cameras on, because some teachers in different schools demand that kids keep cameras on the whole time during distance learning, when I really feel that it doesn't honor the student and their home conditions, and there may be personal reasons why they have to keep the cameras off. And then there's that element of trust and having an open conversation that I want you to keep the camera on, but if you feel you need to keep the camera off for personal reasons, please do so. I trust you're going to get your work done. But because it's such a new time, COVID right now, what are you learning about motivation and distance learning? Or what have you heard?
Well, you know, the first thing I want to mention in this is the pressures I've seen on teachers. So teachers with the COVID virus, they've been put under a lot of confusing pressures and directives, you know, week to week changes in what they're asked to do. And this shows kind of the problems of an absence of a clear structure when educational institutions don't have a clear plan for the teachers who are under them. This really creates confusion and stress on teachers themselves. And I think teachers have had to be really innovative in creating an atmosphere online that can in any way be as engaging as an in-person atmosphere. This is not an easy thing to do. But I think, you know, some of the successful experiments I've seen around this are where people are still keeping in mind the basic principles of autonomy, support, competence, and relatedness in their online teaching. So the first thing is, I think, you know, you do want to be able in an online environment to connect with people. So you want to create opportunities where you can get feedback from them, where you can find out how things are going from their point of view, even if that's a kind of subtle chat room feedback thing that you do, or a kind of group discussion where you reflect on those things with people. I think, you know, providing that two-way street so you can understand what's going on for the person on the other side of that video screen, hugely important in the teaching process. And that also turns out to be motivating, because people who feel connected with you as a teacher are going to be more motivated to engage class. I think, again, also structure. You know, one of the things I've seen in a lot of online learning is it's not really clear where we're going or why we're doing these things. And it's been hard for teachers to kind of put in that kind of structure that allows people to know, here's the pathway we're going on. And I think it's going to take some time till we kind of groove those slots of online learning pathways so that learners know where the journey's headed. And then I think supporting autonomy, I think there's, as you point out, there's this tendency to want to micromanage out of distrust. I don't know what they're doing on the other side of that screen. I don't know what they're doing at home. I don't have my eyes on them, you know? So there's a kind of removal of a kind of control and surveillance that teachers may be used to having. And the knee-jerk reaction to that is to then respond with more micromanagement. but that turns out to be undermining rather than facilitating of engagement and autonomy. So there's a lot of new challenges in the online learning environment, but there are tackleable challenges. They're solvable things. So in some ways, it's also kind of an exciting era of experimentation.
That's how we're trying to frame it up, is that there's a million reasons why it won't work, but actually look at the reasons, look at the opportunities that exist.
Yep.
And we've seen some kids that struggle in face-to-face learning that are thriving in a distance learning setting because they struggle socially. So there are many, many opportunities that come with this. And we're moving slowly back into a hybrid model. But in the snap of our fingers, it can go back to distance learning, you know, and it's going to go back and forth. So it'll be kind of like distance learning 1.0. You learn from it, distance learning 2.0, 3.0. As we go through the process, reflect, refine, and make it better for teachers and students. So I wanted to
ask... One opportunity that's come out in all of this, by the way, and I'm just mostly reflecting here on the United States, is that because people have been learning at home, parents are seeing what's going on in schools in a way they've never seen before. And a lot of parents I've talked to are like, oh my gosh, no wonder my child has been unhappy. No wonder my child's been suffering. And they, you know, we've seen a release in many states in the United States of requirements for high stakes testing, which are actually freeing up teachers to be more focused on the process of what's going on with their students. These are pluses that are growing out of the crisis that we have right now.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to ask you about extrinsic motivation, your work around extrinsic motivation, and what I find really fascinating. And to be honest, I just came across this in the last little while. Like, to me, extrinsic motivation was always very much just reward or punishment. But I heard a talk that you had given that really broke down extrinsic motivation, kind of like a continuum, starting from the wide left, which would be external regulation, to introjection regulation, to identification, to integration. And I found that really fascinating. And I think this is hugely important for teachers to understand that it's not just about rewards and punishment, but can you break down extrinsic motivation into those four areas and just talk a little bit about that so that teachers can really understand the different types of extrinsic motivation?
Well, I'll give it a try. Intrinsic motivation, I think most of the audience probably knows what the term means. It means you're doing something because you find the activity itself really interesting and engaging and enjoyable. A lot of tasks aren't like that. They're not enjoyable at the outset or inherently interesting. And these are things that in order for people to do them, if they're not inherently interesting, you need some kind of extrinsic motivation. You need to be, there's some reason you're doing it that's not inherent in the activity itself. Classically, when people thought about extrinsic motivation, the reasons you would do something is because you get a big reward. So there's a carrot, and that provides the motivation. And of course, or there's the other side of that, which is the stick. Another form of extrinsic motivation is you'll do it. If you don't, I will beat you with a stick. So you've got carrots and sticks, and they can be really powerful motivators. And I think, you know, this is one of the things that behavioristic research really brought out, is if you have powerful enough rewards or a big enough stick, you can get people to do a lot of things, at least in an immediate sense. The problem has never been in the power of rewards and punishments. It's been what happens when you're not standing there with the stick or you don't have the carrot in front. That's when the motivation now is gone, because if the motivation is dependent on carrot and sticks, that means it only exists when the carrots and sticks are present. This is what we call external regulation, and it's a really ineffective way of motivating people over time and creating any kind of sustained motivation. Another kind of extrinsic motivation is now where it's not that you've got a carrot and stick in front of people, it's that they're doing the carrot and stick to themselves. So you've kind of trained your child out. They'll feel bad about themselves, guilty or shamed if they don't do well, or they'll feel proud and great when they can outperform the other kids on a test, because that makes you now proud as a parent. We call this introjection, and sometimes we call it ego involvement. It's when you're motivated by your ego issues, by your self-esteem. And it can be also a really powerful form of motivation, but it's not very stable. a person who's motivated to look good to others or to outperform others is pretty motivated when they get positive feedback, but it can crumble when things start to go wrong. And it's also not very good from a mental health standpoint to be driven around by guilt, shame, and by need for attention and admiration. So another form of extrinsic motivation, which we think of the kind of highest form of extrinsic motivation, is when you do something, not because it's interesting or enjoyable, but you do get why it's important. You get why it's worthwhile. Now you're motivated. Now, okay, it's not that fun, but I see why I'm doing it. And, you know, in your field, in sport, it's like, okay, my practice drills in basketball aren't fun, but I see why they improve my game. Someone has helped me understand that. So now I have a motivation that's internal to me, that's based in good reasons for doing what I'm doing, and then I'm energized to do it for that. So we think of this as a continuum that goes from very controlling, carrot and stick, all the way up to very autonomous. I do it because I value and find worth in this activity. And that, so the issue is not intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. It's really control versus autonomy. Mm-hmm. So you want your children in your classroom to both find interest when they can, but also find value and merit in what they're doing. And these are, so this is why we have tried to give a better name to extrinsic motivation, which is there are some bad forms of extrinsic motivation, and there's some really good forms of extrinsic motivation. And we're trying to promote the latter.
You know, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking the idea of introjection regulation, that idea of self-esteem or guilt, being guilted into doing something. Included in that is it also seeking praise, that if the teacher praises the student will do the work. Is that interjection regulation as well, that the teacher's only or the student's only doing the work because they're receiving praise from the teacher?
Yeah, I think if you're motivated in order to get admiration or praise from others, we would put that under interjection. What you want is to be motivated by wanting to do well. And then, you know, when you get praised, you see that as positive feedback for actually having done well. Now, praise is such a mixed bag. It can be a really positive motivator, but it can also be a real manipulative, controlling thing. And I guess what I want to say is when you praise people, be aware of what your intent is. If your intent is to actually acknowledge something done well or effort put in, then by all means, praise liberally. But if your intent is to use praise to get somebody to do something or to get them to do more of something, then it's going to have a controlling intent, and the learner is going to feel that. Mm-hmm. And it's going to feel controlling rather than supportive. So we say, you know, praise is an art, and you want praise to be informational. It really provides information about efficacy. Praise is not to be used as a motivator, because then it becomes the wrong kind of extrinsic motivation.
Yeah, and that's the power of language. And part of my job as an instructional coach is to record conversations in the classroom between the teacher and the students and student to student, but also really look at teacher language and then record all the questions, all of the statements, all of the commands, everything, you know, student responses, and then to present that data back to the teacher. Let's switch off emotions. You imagine a light switch with emotions on or off, and you really have to switch emotions off when you're receiving that data, because it's not you as a person, it's just information. And I think that's where the language can really be analyzed, and teachers can become more aware of the language they use that might act as a barrier to promoting growth and autonomy in students. But what are some, in your experiences, some data that can be collected in the classroom that might give teachers feedback about the environment that they're creating in order to assess whether or not they're planting the seeds for students to flourish?
You know, I like your general question, because you're suggesting that if we allow people to get feedback in a non-evaluative way, they'll find that informative, and that will lead them to be interested in their own practice and in ways of refining it. And I really do believe that's true. I believe it's in a non-judgmental way, kind of reviewing the practices that we have and looking at their impact, that really helps us make changes happen. That's when I do teacher workshops, that's really what we do. I don't go in and say, oh, here's how you should behave in your classroom. When we talk about principles, people try to act them out. And then what I want to hear is, how do they go wrong? I want to kind of revisit those things and think about, you know, what's going on in the implementation of SDT techniques that didn't work, because that's where the action is at the training. I think I probably lost your question because I got off here on a little bit of a tangent.
Yeah, just the idea of what are some other forms of data that they might be interested or curious about that can help to provide the information they need and feedback they need to continue to improve their practice and really try to create the conditions for an autonomy-supported environment?
Well, you know, I think one kind of data I would want everybody to get is the data that comes from getting in the inside point of view of your own learners. So making sure you check in with every learner in your classroom at different moments in time and say, how's it going for you? What's your experience been? What's going on for you in this classroom? That's the feedback you need to know. Yeah. You need to know how are the ways in which you're teaching impacting the recipients of that teaching practice. So to me, the most important information any of us as motivators can have is what's going on in the perspectives of the people we're trying to motivate. What is that? I think sometimes just watching teaching practice really can help that. Just observing and letting people comment themselves on what's occurring. But, you know, our research shows that even things like tone of voice, it's not just the words, it's even the way in which something's conveyed. You know, you can say that now is the time for doing a task. You can say, do that task now, or, you know, now's the time for doing the task. Those are two different, those are the same directive, but they come across so differently. One feels controlling and the other feels inviting. These are the kind of things we want to attend to. How stylistically are we either interfering with a sense of agency or are we supporting that sense of agency? And when kids are lost, are we providing the structure they need to get unlost? Or are we leaving them in a lurch and just putting more demands on them? You know, one of the problems I've seen a lot in classroom practice is that when things go wrong, people start to pull out the bigger stick or the bigger carrot, thinking, oh, it's a motivation problem. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's not a motivation problem. Sometimes it could be a processing problem. It could be an emotional problem. There's a number of things. So part of the importance of getting the internal frame of reference of learners is that helps you diagnose where the problem is. Pulling out more rewards, pulling out bigger sticks, never diagnoses properly, so often doesn't solve the problem.
You're describing the idea of student voice, activating student voice, and having a list of questions that you might ask the students to get their feedback about your own teaching and then act on that. And that's another aspect of the work that I do is I will pull students randomly from class to ask them questions that the teacher wants me to ask them. So I then gather the feedback and give it back to the teacher. And then the teacher will share their thoughts with the class to dig more into what it is they're thinking. And then there's nothing greater than bringing value, letting the students know that they're valued, than to actually say, I care about what you think and I'm actually acting on it. And it's part of what I want to do to get better, to do a better job for you. So the power of student voice.
By the way, there was a study recently where this was a Korean study, I believe, where they showed that when teachers did just what you said, when they inquired with students about their point of view and their perspectives on things, and that students actually rated those teachers as more competent than the ones who don't do that. So sometimes teachers think that's a sign of weakness if I ask their students what they think about things or it's a distracting. On the contrary, it leads students to believe that teacher has confidence in what they're doing. And that was a remarkable study. I think it was Yongxin Yang who did that work.
Oh, great. Yeah. Because we've taken the idea of the professional inquiry. So rather than the administrators going in and visiting the classroom twice a year, telling the teacher what they did well, telling them what they need to do better, and then that's it. We encourage the teachers to set their own professional inquiries and to make it a very self-authoring process. And then the teachers have coaches like myself or other coaches in the school who then help to facilitate their professional inquiry. And one of the key data points is student voice. So it's very much within the culture of our school, and we're finding a lot of success with it. It's been in action now about 6 years, and every year it's getting a little deeper and deeper and more rewarding for teachers.
You know, one of the successful interventions that I saw recently was one that was done in Israel, and it was done by Asor Kaplan and others there. But what I really liked about the intervention was that same attitude that you just expressed was part of the intervention with teachers themselves. So the team went in, they explained some of the basic principles about self-determination theory, but the teachers in each school developed a program for how to implement it. It was through their voice, through their iterations, through their discussions, and said, okay, here's the autonomy we want to get. How do we get there in our school? What are the ways we can do that? And they developed their own individualized programs within the schools. And it's now, I think the 3-year data I saw is a very successful program. And part of what's happened in the schools is there's been reduced violence, reduced bullying in the schools, because the whole interpersonal atmosphere of the schools has changed. It's called the I-Vow intervention. It's just an example of how empowering teachers is also part of helping them empower students.
Yeah, the idea of self.
I think too often we think teachers aren't the professionals they are, and teachers have to be our partners in helping school reform happen. In fact, the leaders, they can be the only leaders in school reform. That's one of the reasons I really liked that, because the intervention itself followed the principles of SDT.
Oh, that's great. That's amazing. I love hearing that schools actually, a lot of schools will talk about doing this or talk about giving teachers autonomy, but at the end of the day, they don't really do it. Schools that are actually doing it and taking that bold, courageous step to actually do it will be the ones that lead the way for other schools to do the same.
Yeah. And if you look worldwide, internationally, the most successful countries in terms of education are the ones who empower their teachers, who treat their teachers as professionals, who pay them well, who give them opportunities for further education and development, who are really putting on the emphasis there rather than on just pressuring people toward outcomes.
Yeah, for sure. So, Richard, just to honor your time here, I just have a couple questions to close. And one of the questions I want to ask you, and you know, you've had such an amazing career and you've inspired countless teachers and around the world, and not just in education, but other industry and organizations as well. But if you had to look back at your career, what do you think you're most proud of?
I guess what I'm most proud of is that there's a community of researchers now in self-determination theory. We meet every 3 years. We have an international conference every 3 years. And I look at the excitement there. I look at the generativity. I look at the new directions they're taking it. I'm looking at the things that I'm being taught by everybody who's part of the organization now. I love that there's that excitement around these ideas, and that people are taking them further in directions I could never have envisioned. So it's kind of the feeling of having helped seed something. Of course, nothing's original in the world. You know, we stole all our ideas from other people, and I'm hoping that others will steal ours very quickly. But, you know, I'm proud that there's a community of people trying to make the world better through providing conditions to help people flourish.
Yeah, in all industry, you know, and you know, music and art and sport. I mean, that's the beautiful thing is that I'm obviously sport means so much to me, and I've devoted my life to sport and physical activity and training physical education teachers. But I also coach art teachers and music teachers who have loves and passions of their own discipline. And these principles apply, these things apply directly in their work as well.
I just finished a chapter with Paul Evans on music education and you know the dynamics in music education being so relevant to SDT. I agree with you, but I think it's in every subject matter, you know, whether it's mathematics or music or you know, sport or PE or physics. It doesn't matter. These principles have relevance.
Yeah. And just, I have one last question, but just a quick little story is that my son just started playing golf. He's fallen in love with golf. I played golf my whole life,
I'm sorry for your son. This is going to be like a lifelong battle.
It's been like a year and a half. He's probably down to a 10 handicap now. And throughout his learning journey, I just bit my tongue when I would see him make mistakes in his swing. I just bite your tongue. Don't say anything to him. Don't tell him how to swing the club. Let him figure it out. But I've really stuck to that. And when we're on the course, he might hit a shot that's not so great, but I'll really commend him on. I love the way you were thinking before the shot, the way you lined up, you know, your dedication, your commitment to the shot. It didn't happen the way you wanted, but you did all the right things. Just keep focusing that way, you know. So I refuse to talk about technique with him, and he has truly figured it out on his own. So I try to think about the praise I give him that is not judgmental in any way and very encouraging. And these are the things that I'm learning to apply in my own life with my own kids and their pursuits as well. And I really believe it works. But so, Richard, just to close out the show, where can people find you on social media?
Well, first of all, we have a website. Just go to selfdeterminationtheory.org. And on there is a lot of free information, a lot of articles, a lot of things you can download, films you can watch. There's a page on education there. So if you go to education research there, you'll find, you know, a whole page on the latest research. Erica Patel, who's really a great educational psychologist, is the editor for that page. And so, you know, she tries to keep up with the latest things happening in SDT that are on there. So I would go to that web. That's kind of the core thing. We're also on social media. We have SDT Facebook group. We have SDT on LinkedIn. Through all the typical social media, but the website is kind of the core place, and you can be a member. You can pay just $1 to be a member, whatever you can afford if you want to do that. But you can just access things for free too. So go to selfdeterminationtheory.org.
Okay, great. I really want to thank you for your time. It was a great conversation, and I'm going to keep following your work, and I'm really inspired by what you do.
Well, thanks very much. It was a great conversation, Andy. It's nice to talk to you and hear about your techniques, and hopefully we'll get this chance again.
Yeah, for sure. So just stay on the line. I just want to debrief with you just for 1 minute, and I'll just close out the show. So everybody, thank you very much for listening to this podcast with Dr. Richard Ryan, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
You're listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vasily.